This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amanda Kennel, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Raina Dennison, author of Anime, A Critical Introduction. The book responds to anime's global success by examining how academics, journalists, and fans understand anime, and what we understand that term to mean, in Japan, the United States, and the United Kingdom. Dennison shows that our understanding of anime is bound up in the idea of genre. Anime as a genre, or even meta-genre, but also genres like shoujo, shonen, horror, and science fiction, all of which I'll be asking about shortly. Ultimately, A Critical Introduction is a tour de force that somehow threads together analyses of specific anime, the reception of those anime, and anime production and distribution technologies in three nations on three continents. Dr. Raina Dennison, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Amanda. That's such a wonderfully generous introduction, and it's my absolute pleasure to be here with you today.
Oh, no, it's entirely warranted by this book, which is absolutely wonderful. I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself.
Of course. Hi. Yes, everyone. It's great to be here. So I am currently a professor of film and digital arts here at the University of Bristol in the UK, where I'm head of department and head of subject for film and television. I've been a specialist in anime for professionally about 15 years, but I've been in love with anime since I was a child. I'm one of the generation, and this will age me horribly, but I'm one of the generation who watched anime in America when I was growing up, on television, and had no idea it was from Japan. And then for me, anime reemerged in the 1990s when I was a teenager and friends would sidle up to you in the playground and say things like, "Hey, I found this really great DVD. It's called Akira. Do you want to watch it?" And then, you know, mind blown thereafter, I rediscovered Japanese animation and discovered how long it had been traveling around the world and changing everyone's appreciation of what animation could do and what animation could be. So for me, that was where, I guess, my love affair with anime restarted as a teenager. And then it was again a revelation, having finished a degree in Japanese, that we were allowed as academics to study film and television. And that within that, we were allowed to study anime. And so my whole career has been spent, I feel so far anyway, exploring this terrain and finding all the amazing stories that anime has brought to us, the amazing styles of animation it has brought to us, and then trying to bring those and proselytize for those with people around the world who maybe are just getting into anime, just discovering it, but also those who are trying to take popular culture seriously and trying to find ways to speak about popular culture in an academic, scholarly way, because that itself has been a growing field just for the last 25, 30 years. And it's been great to see it flourishing and to see so many people now coming into the field and doing amazing studies of anime. I meet brilliant PhD students all the time now and recent graduates from PhD programs who've spent their time doing research into aspects of Japanese animation and Japanese media culture that 2 decades ago, no one would have thought to even look at, but now are proving to be these amazing new resources for all of us as scholars.
Sounds like an incredibly vibrant and growing field. I'm so glad you can come talk to us about it. So one of the things that struck me even before I ever read this book is that it's part of the Bloomsbury Film Genres series. And I just want to ask, you know, what led you to analyze anime from the perspective of genre?
So this all started in a conversation I had with Malt Yankovic, who was the series editor at the time. And we had a complete disagreement about whether or not anime was a genre. And at the end of a meal we'd had together, he just turned to me and went, "You should write a book about this, because you have so much to say about it. You should write a book about it." And that idea really stuck with me, because anime is not a genre, but of course anime is a genre, and it completely depends on your perspective, on how you grew up watching it, and whether you consider something like shonen to be a subgenre or a genre in its own right, or a kind of anime, another different kind of category, a transmedia category. I mean, there's so many ways to look at anime, and that's the joy of it in many respects. But what it started for me was me thinking about it structurally, about how what anime is in Japan is different to what anime is in America, and even how there are differences between America and the UK. Certainly there's differences that we see all the time now between the popular genres in different places. So within anime, there are flows, ebbs and flows of different kinds of production that do well at home and different ones that do well abroad. And it's very fun, but also very difficult to predict what's going to be popular in any given place. And I suppose these days, we need to add the confusion that streaming platforms are adding into the mix. You know, is Castlevania anime? These are questions that I think will vex future academics, possibly. I don't want to touch that one, because that comes back to questions of does being anime mean you have to make it in Japan? Does the product have to come from Japan? Or is anime a style now that people can adopt around the world? It's certainly become very influential in animation from places like South Korea, where they're doing a lot of the in-betweening for the Japanese anime industry. But we're seeing that bleed into the aesthetics of things like the Voltron remake that DreamWorks did for streaming Netflix. So there's wonderful, I mean, you started me talking about this and I'm not going to be able to stop again because I love this topic, but it starts these really interesting patterns of production and patterns of aesthetic exchange and influence that I find completely compelling as ways of tracing the importance of anime as it moves around the world and through time. Absolutely, yes. I suppose the rather shorter answer would be I started thinking about it structurally, and when I did, I discovered that anime wasn't a genre, but that anime behaves generically in very overt, big ways. So there's some really interesting crossover between thinking about anime as a genre and thinking about anime's genres and anime's generic ways of encapsulating production aesthetics and production trends.
And I think that gets into an idea you introduce, which is that anime, or the idea of considering anime as a meta genre. So what does that mean, and how does looking at anime as a meta genre change our understanding of it?
So again, it depends on the perspective you want to take on it. I suppose meta, we could get very philosophical about what meta genres might mean, but to keep it relatively simple, I suppose the way to think about it is within Japan, anime is so much more than a genre. It is a whole industry, and that industry contains multitudes. So in Japan, anime is almost too big to be thought about as a genre. And yet, in that classic genre way, we know anime when we see it. And if it comes out of the Japanese industry and it's animated and it's two-dimensional, you're probably thinking it's anime. But in Japan, anime is both about the production of animation, but it's also more than that. And that's where the meta side of it comes in. Because anime, as a product of largely television animation, has become the linchpin that holds together massive franchises that often start in manga, but can end up in live action film, in video games, in musicals, theatrical musicals, and all kinds of wonderful things. So I find anime is really interesting to think about in that meta-generic way, because it both encapsulates genres, but it's more than that. And in being more than a medium, it becomes, I think, meta. It becomes more than and extends far beyond the reaches of a regular genre.
Mm-hmm. And you also sort of, in your answer there, you get at another thing that the book does, which I find absolutely fascinating. You pointed out that when we see something, we can recognize it as anime. But you also point out that the word anime has a different meaning in Japan, where it just means animation. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Japan. Now, because of that shifting in the meaning of terms, I guess we should say, your book tackles anime and its reception in Japan, but also in the United States and the United Kingdom. And, you know, it was really eye-opening for me because, you know, I know that anime means animation in Japanese, but some of the other terms that you really, you sort of defined for different or in different places, I had not realized quite what the distinctions were until I read your book. And they really have a really important shift in how we understand what's going on. So to get into that a little bit more, though, I think, could you tell us why you chose the United States and the United Kingdom as your sort of secondary and tertiary sites of research, as it were?
I mean, obviously, so these days, if we were going to start this study again, probably the most interesting places to look at would be places like South Korea and China, where anime's importance has rapidly grown over the last 15 years. Since the relaxation about imports and since particularly South Korea has been doing so much outsourcing work for Japanese animators. So it's really building and changing the South Korean animation industry. I'll stop doing that, I promise. But there's a wonderful connection there, I think, in terms of industrial shifts and changes that we probably want to look at that would make different points. But for me, when I started this book, I was interested in the kind of vibrancy of the early exchanges between the Japanese animation industry and other animation industries. And I was also interested in how difficult it has been for anime to find markets outside of Japan as well. So on the one hand, you know, as soon as Astro Boy by Tezuka comes out in the 1960s, it's already in America just a year later. So when anime on television is born, it's essentially born as a transnational medium and immediately is being translated and sent abroad and distributed in the States. So I thought it made sense because of that early connection to look at that connection with America. It's also a connection that's been theorized quite a lot lately. And subsequent to this book coming out, there's been brilliant work being done about early anime fandom in the States and some great work looking at the kind of networks and how it's spread to America, which is certainly very welcome. But at the time I wrote this, there wasn't a lot of that. So I was going back into fan magazines and early publications where fans were talking about anime and trying to piece together for myself as much as anything else why those connections emerged. What was it about Japanese anime that American animation fans were suddenly discovering? What was inspiring them in anime? So I was really interested in those early connections. And for me, it made sense after that to think about the development and to use America as a case study for where anime takes hold and how it then changes and shifts over time in reputation, but also in meanings. And I found the case studies so fascinating because, you know, as you said before, what anime means to people in Japan very much was different to what anime meant to people as home video took off in the 1980s and 90s in America, when only very specific anime texts were coming across. And that really shaped perceptions of what anime was for a very long time and still today. Just recently, I was seeing people talking about Japanese cinema at an event in London where they were talking about anime's slightly risque reputation when it came across in the 1990s, and people were all nodding in the audience. And I find that lingering impression of anime as something that is extreme is very interesting when we look at those overseas markets in the States, because of course most fans will know anime is everything. It's for little kids. It is pornographic. It has all the genres and is made for all of the audiences. It's not something that is niche in the way that it was initially presented to fans. And fans actually have been hugely important internationally doing the work to explain what anime is to one another and to explore its generic landscapes and to promote those different genres to each other and to new audiences. And I think fans, particularly American and European fans, have done huge amounts of work for industry globally to help people understand what anime is. I think fans are a huge part of that, really.
That was one of the things that sort of struck me about the fan communities in the US and the UK. In America, there was a bit of an emphasis on sort of explaining that anime is not pornography or not just pornography. But then in the UK, when I first started to learn about the fan communities, there was so much history being written within the community about what they were doing that I had not seen anywhere else, which was truly fascinating.
If anybody fancies it, Leah Holmes, so L-E-A-H, Holmes is in Sherlock, has done an amazing study of UK fandom, and you can see her timeline for UK fandom of anime online. She's got a website where she's done that timeline, and it's brilliant. She's spent a lot of time talking to fans and mapping their memories of when anime first came over and who did that work. And I'm happy to say Helen McCarthy, who's absolutely wonderful, was right at ground zero. She's one of the big anime authors, but she was there early in the life of anime's importation to the UK, doing the work to proselytize for it, running conventions, writing, editing fanzines. And she was a one-woman marketing campaign for anime in the UK, I think. And I think we can thank her for a lot of what we get over here even now. She's been a huge linchpin in the history of anime's kind of importation here to the UK, because she did a huge amount of work to map what was coming into Europe, what was coming into the States, to put fans in touch with one another and get them exchanging tapes back in the days when there was no, or very little at least, legitimate distribution.
Those were good days.
I don't know. I prefer now when I can go to Crunchyroll or Netflix and very easily watch the things my students are talking about that they like. And I think my students now are one of my favorite barometers for what's what's big in anime as it comes across from Japan to the rest of the world. We have lots of international students here at Bristol, and they're amazing. They're really engaged with anime, and it's been great talking with them recently about what they're watching and what they love.
It is so helpful now that I am no longer a teenager myself to have that kind of help. My own nephew informed me that My Hero Academia is huge amongst the middle school set.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I keep up with it. But I had a wonderful experience just this summer. I did a lecture for school children on manga, actually. And it was brilliant to do because I got to think about how manga are educational, how there are loads of manga out there that are teaching us, and anime, of course, because many of them are turned into anime. They're actually teaching us about the world around us, about our own bodies, about science, you know, science, not just science fiction. So, you know, recently things like Dr. Stone and Cells at Work have been brilliant, almost textbooks that you can read about how the body functions or about, you know, the components that go into creating a cell phone. You know, it's really interesting to see how what we see of anime has changed so dramatically since those early days of Akira and Ghost in the Shell coming over and being the kind of high profile generic touchstones of science fiction. Now there's that genre has just so much more in it. And I think that's just wonderful to see.
It has really diversified because, as you say, programs like Cells at Work are straight up science in a certain level. But really, one genre in particular has always been associated with anime, especially outside of Japan, and that is science fiction with Akira and Ghost in the Shell and so much. Why is science fiction such a big part of anime and its movement across the world?
So I suppose at the beginning of the conversation, you have things like Astro Boy. And there's logical reasons why, very much like in the development of CG animation, which starts out with bugs and robots and things that are easy to animate when you're using a computer. I think in some ways we see a similar sort of thing happening in early anime where it's picking up on popular trends in manga. So Astro Boy is one of Tezuka's most popular manga, if not the most popular one he ever did. And it's building on existing brands, therefore, to build anime as something popular. It's a way of managing the risk. If you animate something that people already know and love, it makes it a lot less risky. So there's an aspect to the early popularity of sci-fi and anime, kind of then breeding more interest in sci-fi and anime. And it's worth noting that boys' anime develops faster than girls' anime. So from the 1960s with your kind of giant robots and small robot, popular science fiction shows, very utopian a lot of the time, but not quite as utopian as something like Star Trek. We get from that into the much more complex, almost soap opera narratives of big, long-running shows, things like Gundam, of course, but also big early hits. And this is really interesting to me because the first anime that really become massive hits are sci-fi. And it's not just Tezuka's Astro Boy. It's also things like Space Battleship Yamato, which it does okay on TV. But then they repackage a couple of episodes into a movie and they discover fans are willing to wait outside for hours and hours to come and see this movie. And it's the start of that kind of growth of the otaku style fandom that becomes so important. And that then informs what gets made later. So from the success of something like Space Battleship Yamato, you get people like Hideaki Anno, who creates Neon Genesis Evangelion, becoming interested in anime because they've seen those early success stories. And, you know, and they start to make their own anime. Some of them, like Anno, start out as fans, making almost kind of fan-made animation and then segue into industry. But the industry itself is already very savvy by the 1970s about what sells toys in particular. And so your giant robot anime sell toys, and that's another reason that they dominate the market. And as those kinds of sci-fi shows dominate the market, they start to slowly filter through into other markets. So something like Gatchaman, the which is, you know, really about a team of science. You know, it's a science fiction team of that's very influenced by, or very influenced by, kind of superheroes from America, but also influenced by the growing interest in tokusatsu or special effects genre live action production. You know, and that's that sort of Power Rangers style of science fiction in live action television. They all start to emerge in the 70s as well. So you get the kind of the science team. Sort of group of anime heroes that gets conjoined to sci-fi narratives and of space travel and space aliens, and it gives the main human characters or science who might be superheroic in one way or another, or robots, it gives the positive characters outsiders to fight that are without connection to, you know, wartime influences or the legacies of the Second World War. And so I think that's part of the reason in Japan, at least, why sci-fi is so important. It gives a fantasy landscape in which Japan can be free to create heroes who can fight villains from outside without harking back to history too much. So, and then of course from there you get the development of all kinds of science fiction subgenres, and some of those start like with Akira and Ghost in the Shell, that start to break through into the Western market a bit more. And we see it even now with, you know, huge hits like My Hero Academia that we mentioned a minute ago. But there's loads of these shows now that I think are playing with notions of genre in very reflexive ways, that, you know, play with the superhero genre, that play with science fiction, that play with educational narratives. You know, there's all kinds of things going on that I think are really very, very knowing in terms of what the audiences know going in and what the creators expect audiences to take away from it. Not least, of course, moving away from sci-fi for a moment, the growing number of anime and manga that are now about the creation of anime and manga. So from Bakuman to, I suppose, the, you know, biographical works by manga artists to, you know, Shirobako and things like that that are about the creation of anime. So if you want to know how anime is made, you can now go watch an anime about how anime is made.
It is starting to get rather circular.
You talk about a meta-genre, right?
Mm-hmm. But we see some of that reflexiveness you're describing even in genres like cyberpunk and steampunk. Mm-hmm. And you mention in the book, steampunk, you know, why is steampunk named steampunk? It's somewhat because of the influence of the pre-existing cyberpunk genre. The two came to prominence at rather different points in time, but also at different points in anime's international growth. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how did that sort of affect their reception abroad?
It's a really good question. I'm going to struggle to answer it, I think, because I would need to have all the materials in front of me to do it justice, but I'll do my best. So there are always shifts in genres, and genre shifts can happen within particular countries at completely different times. So obviously William Gibson's Neuromancer is a globally translated book, and it makes cyberpunk something people know about in Japan as much as they know about it in the US. But it's a starting point for a kind of futuristic fantasy that Japan is part of, in which Japan is a prominent figure. And so it's interesting to see something like Akira getting made sense of outside of Japan in relation to cyberpunk, when in Japan, of course, they're very aware of its connections, potential connections to those wider genres and to things like Neuromancer. But what I find interesting about the sci-fi of that era, particularly things like Akira and Ghost in the Shell, is that they are playing with future fantasies that are both future looking and retrospective historically at the same time. So from my personal point of view, I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in academia about how Akira is a form of working through of the disasters that happened in, or the atomic bombings that happened in Japan and at the end of the Second World War, but also the Bikini Atoll testing. And there has been a lot of discussion of it as a kind of hibakusha cinema, or bomb survivor cinema. But at the same time, it's also a complete fantasy about a dystopic future version of Japan in which the wartime legacy is very different. And then the existence of Akira has changed the nature of threat and the nature of explosions and bombs within the Japanese psyche. So there's something very, very tense in that relationship. And I think by the time we get to the notion of steampunk and people making sense of anime using, you know, basically the same directors doing different versions of these stories or doing new versions of these stories, what we get with something like steampunk is a much more distant historical point of view coming into play. I mean, for me, what's fascinating about both of them is the attention to detail in this, in the world building. And I think the world building in both Steam Boy, which I talk about quite a bit, and Akira, which I talk about quite a bit in the book, is the attention to contemporary Japan in the first movie, in Akira, but the attention to Victorian London in the second. So that says everything about the kind of touchstones, the touch points for those two movies, and the way they look backward and forward and completely different ways and relate to Japan's present point of view in different ways.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, something like the distinctions between Ghost in the Shell and Skycrawlers are much more difficult to unpack because there's a lot more philosophy at work in both of them. And the constant references to European philosophers is something I find very interesting in both of those movies. There's a lot of intertextuality brought into them by the filmmakers that's about trying to represent philosophical principles in sci-fi. So I find those ideas very interesting as well. What is the self? What is selfhood? How do we relate to the world? What do we believe ourselves to be, and what connections do we have to one another? I mean, those are very fundamental questions, and much bigger ones in some ways than the questions that are being asked in films like Akira and Steam Boy. But I think at the same time, the filmmakers are engaging with sci-fi in different ways there that makes their films equally rich, just with different agenda attached to them.
It is really fascinating to see, because cyberpunk and steampunk really didn't, they weren't really all that far separated in time. You see cyberpunk in the late 1980s and into the 1990s. You see steampunk in the 1990s into the 2000s. And yet they have this fascinating, as you said, a sort of variance in time between the far future and at least a few decades, if not a century or so in the past, at the same time. Now, I have to say, I want to talk about one other genre, and it's the one I was a little leery going into that final chapter on horror. because I'm not the best with the scary films, I will say. Yet I found that I had actually seen almost every work you mentioned, from classics like Vampire Hunter D and Blood the Last Vampire, to popular favorites like Vampire Night, and then even some more obscure but really well-regarded titles like Ghost Hunt, which is one of my personal favorites.
Oh, I love it, yeah.
And that got me interested in just sort of this question of horror and how we understand horror and how it circulates, because I don't think of myself as someone who searches out scary TV shows and movies, and yet I had seen so many. So how is it that, you know, even someone like me can unknowingly consume so many anime that are in fact part of the horror genre?
Well, that was my big question for that chapter. Is there such a thing as anime horror? I think it's one of those things where when we think of horror, we think of the point, that kind of numinous, that kind of liminal point where the realistic of live action meets the impossible. And so the special effects are often what makes a thing impossible. When you start to animate something, it becomes much more difficult to do particular kinds of horror because there's no real. There's no way you can go. And then the kind of very abstracted anime human character walks past a doorway and be in the doorway, there's a shadow, because it's not connected to our world in the same way. It makes it harder to tell. I felt at the time going in, it surely makes it impossible to tell scary stories like this. And so I was skeptical about the idea that there could be anime horror. And if there was, I wasn't sure it could be scary. It could be gross for sure, but I wasn't convinced it could be scary. And anyone who's seen Tokyo Ghoul knows exactly what I'm talking about in terms of the distinction between the two.
It's, oh, yes.
Again, another wonderful show. Just the aesthetics in these shows are all, I think, really disparate and really incredible. And something like Tokyo Ghoul is doing some really interesting things with the look of anime and playing with the look of it. But I digress. So the chapter in the book was looking for the traces of horror in the things that were talked about, in the way these shows were talked about in Japan, but also in the way they were talked about as they moved around the world. And what was interesting is, you know, there's very little questioning of whether or not anime horror existed by the time these shows made it out of Japan. But in Japan, they weren't talked about in that way so much as a horror genre. The word horror wasn't really being used very much, so it was much more specific. These were, you know, kyuketsuki or vampire stories, or they were yokai stories, or kind of, oh, how do you translate yokai? Ghost, monster, numinous thing that bumps in the night? Any of the
all
above.
All of the above?
But, you know, they were yokai stories. Sometimes they were ghost stories, but they were very much more talked about in very much more specific ways. And they were connected to each other generically in those specific traditions. So, you know, people would talk about the previous example that had been popular. So when they were viewing a new vampire show, they go, oh, this is kind of the latest one since we had Blood the Last Vampire. Or when they do Blood Sea, they're kind of like, oh, yeah, Blood the Last Vampire is where this story started. And this is the sequel kind of, or prequel or something connected to it. And so there were really interesting ways that they were kind of in the process of building an understanding of horror that was specific to different kinds of monsters, typically, but also specific to genre mixing of different kinds. So there's interesting romantic horror anime. Things like Vampire Nights is a really good example of one of those hybrid ones where it's as much about young girls being in love with vampires as it is about the vampires themselves.
Those are very pretty vampires.
Very pretty vampires. I mean, yeah, Japan did that quite a while before the Americans got in on the act, I think. Sparkly vampires is not new. but I think as well there's something interesting about the nature of horror in that, and what kinds of horror work well in anime. So yes, I think there are kinds of horror anime, the the more kind of splatter, like they're a splatterpunk anime, I suspect. But there's also, you know, the ones that emphasize blood and guts and gore. And that style seems to have been hugely popular in certain moments. But it's when you come across things like Ghost Hunt, which sit in a completely different part of the genre, that I find it fascinating. Because that is a show that's about creepiness and trying to scare you, but it's also about a group of skeptics who go around trying Scooby-Doo style to explain away the mysterious. And so I find those kinds of shows fascinating for the way they present a form of kind of anime horror, but at the same time undercut the possibility of horror. And allow you to have that frisson of fear creeping in, and using sound particularly to create eerie atmospheres within the show, but at the same time end the show by explaining at least as much as it is possible to explain. I mean, I always love it when shows leave the door, and horror movies leave the door open to future scares. You know, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that the way that horror kind of exists without existing, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. In Japan, and the way that things get identified not as this overarching horror genre, but as the very specific kyuketsuki or vampire genre, does kind of speak to how what we think of as a genre in America mm-hmm. or in the United Kingdom isn't necessarily how that genre is thought of in Japan.
And completely, one, yeah.
Well, one really fascinating example that I just hadn't even thought of, I hadn't even realized was different until I read your book, was Nichijouke. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what Nichijouke is, and maybe also what we in America and in the United Kingdom might think it is that it is not.
So, I mean, this is another one where translation is difficult. So Nichijouke is just kind of everyday style anime. Usually sits somewhere around the shoujo genre, typically, but doesn't always. And it's usually translated as slice of life anime, but it doesn't have to be. In fact, the show Nichijouke, which has that title, isn't Nichijouke in genre, which is very frustrating to me as someone who studies genre, when they have literally given the show that name and then they put all the fantasy stuff in it that is not at all the fantastical elements in it that are not typical of the genre. It makes it very hard to talk coherently about what the genre might be. But I found it really interesting because I thought it would be slice of life. I thought it would be talked about a slice of life as well. So these are shows that look at the everyday lives of young people in Japan. That's what I expected to be writing in that chapter. And instead I found the more I looked at it, the more it was industrially specific. So there were particular companies that were specializing in this sort of anime creation, most notably Kyoto Animation or KyoAni, which had, through Lucky Star and K-On!, a couple of really big hits in the Nichijouke genre. And that was fascinating because there was this assumption that these were shows that were, you know, in that kind of Nichijouke everyday style, that would be about young girls who go to a club and make a bit of music or who hang out with each other over lunch. And again, I assumed that these would be shows aimed at girls because they were so close in style and in content to the kinds of things we've seen in shoujo anime. But no, they were aimed at men and middle-aged men at that, and were designed for moe, or to get a kind of a fandom or a fire burning inside of people to protect and nurture these girls. And I found that kind of social phenomenon around anime is something you have to engage with Japan, and you have to engage with the discussions happening in fandom in Japan to find out about. And again, this has become much better known since I wrote the book. I think more people have written about it since I wrote the book, which is great. But at the time when I was looking at it, it was a real odyssey of discovery for me. I went in, again, as with horror, expecting one thing and came out the other side of the research going, well, didn't see that coming. And that's what makes doing genre studies fun, because you are if you're doing a genre study, typically what you do is you look to the genres that are either emerging to find out how they're forming, or you're looking for big genres that everyone's talked about. So horror was one I included in the book simply because it's probably the best, that and the Western in film studies are probably the best ever most discussed genre categories. Mm-hmm. And we don't get very many Westerns in anime, so the horror one made sense to me to look at. I'm not saying there aren't any, I'm just saying they're not as common mm-hmm. as the horror ones. But I do think thinking about what's been theorized and how it's been theorized, and then seeing where alternative forms, modes of production, other countries' interpretations of genres can give us a completely different view and picture of what's going on in cultures, but also in genres, is really important. So not just assuming that when we say slice of life, we've understood a genre in Japan, it is important to me. We need to actually investigate what those translations mean for us as academics, but also what they mean for different audiences in different parts of the world. You know, in some places in the world, saying Nichijouke, people will have an immediate picture in their head about what that is. But if you say slice of life, you'll probably have a slightly different image of than what is actually going on. And that's why I thought it was important to talk about that genre in the book.
Mm. And the trick that Nichijouke and its meanings turns on relates to something we've kind of brought up but not gotten into too much detail about yet, which is the two terms shoujo and shonen.
Yeah.
Ostensibly girls and boys, but how do those come into play with anime?
I mean, this is almost as bad as trying to define anime itself when I got into the research. You're not really talking about genres, again, or not genres as we typically define them outside of Japan. So instead of talking about a kind of content or a style of production or a type of story with shoujo and shonen, you're literally just talking about the market, who they're sold to. And that makes them fascinating as these shows move around the world, because things like XXXHolic that was released in Japan was initially aimed at more, it came out as a manga in a shonen manga, but by the time it gets to America, its fans are majority female. So there's an interesting way that things flip and change between countries and between markets. So those categories of shoujo and shonen are very unstable in some ways, but they're also absolutely dominant in others. And they describe not just an anime genre, but also a manga genre and ways of marketing to particular audience groups. So you're thinking, if you're making a show and you're making it for female audiences between the ages of what, 8 and 15, you're probably talking about shoujo. But that could involve any number of different kinds of genre, any number of different styles, any number of different types of production. And the franchises that can grow up around those shows as well are hugely diverse. You know, never mind, you know, different channels in Japan showing different kinds of anime and calling them the same thing, or something like the Noitamina slot on Fuji Television, which is trying to do something different and is taking genres and creating them, recreating them, or giving creators license to produce different styles of genre in that slot because they're aiming them at more adult women, which is unusual. So there's all these really fascinating things going on with the categories of shoujo and shonen. Shonen is the massive dominant one, though, as I'm sure you're well aware. So shonen manga outsell shoujo manga by a magnitude of just a massive number, a huge magnitude. They dominate the market. And for that reason, I'm finding it increasingly interesting watching things like My Hero Academia, which have their action narratives that are very shonen in style. They're now much more interested in genre ideas than they seem to have been in maybe previous generations. Though there are, of course, interesting women turning up in the shonen category, interesting female characters turning up in shoujo and shonen, of course, but particularly in shonen for a long time. But I think at the moment what we're seeing is there's some really interesting ensemble casts being created that fit within the shonen category, but then have important female characters that are almost the protagonists. So Kimetsu no Yaiba is another one where you have a pair of characters, a brother and a sister, and the sister is less dominant than the brother, but she's just as important in terms of the narrative, in terms of agency. I think she's a very, very peculiar, very interesting representation of a shoujo within a shounen category anime that defies our ability to easily pin down where the shows are going and who they're being aimed at, I suspect. And the aestheticization of shonen in particular in recent years, the kind of really dramatic style of something like My Hero Academia or Kimetsu no Yaiba, are presenting us with really interesting, groundbreaking, I think, new ways of thinking about shonen in particular. But for anybody who's not a massive nerd the way I am, shonen is your category of sports, action, sci-fi, manga and anime that has dominated the market for a very long time. It's why the success of something like Studio Ghibli is so interesting, because they've only very rarely played up to notions of shoujo and shonen. Castle in the Sky was technically a shonen main character in a shonen adventure movie. But Studio Ghibli really became famous and successful off the back of a series of shoujo productions. So I find that fascinating to think about how even some of the biggest production companies in Japan have bounced back and forth between the categories to try and find a successful formula for their films and TV shows. I'm sorry, this is one where I could answer that question all day, and I'm not sure I did it justice. Please feel free to ask anything else that you can think of about this, but I suspect that's one where we could, with shoujo and shonen, we could talk about it all day.
And anime too. What is anime? Yeah. Those three questions will never have a settled answer, I have a feeling. But since you brought up Studio Ghibli, they do, you know, if people know of Studio Ghibli films in the US and the UK, they generally have a very sort of set idea of what Studio Ghibli is and what it does. And it's very much a film company, as it's understood, an animated film company. But as you get into in the book, in terms of the products that they make, well, it's just so much more diverse than that. And how they've held all of that together is really fascinating as well. So would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
I mean, yeah, my starting point for this was when I read Helen McCarthy's book on Hayao Miyazaki. And she's got this wonderful chapter towards the end of the book where she talks about how much merchandising Studio Ghibli does. And anyone who's been to Japan will know that that is absolutely true. Go to any department store and you'll find a rack of Totoro's somewhere in the kids section. And go to any DVD store, there'll be a special Studio Ghibli section usually. This is one of Japan's biggest, most successful blockbuster companies. And it is treated as something special and different in Japan very much. But one of the things that I wanted to raise in the book is that the people we know from Studio Ghibli is only a very small number of people that get talked about a lot. Hayao Miyazaki talked about a huge amount. There's lots of academic work on his films, but it's largely been work on his films as films and the aesthetics of them or the themes that they raise. Issa Takahata, who was involved with Studio Ghibli from its inception, there's less written about in academic terms. I'm currently finishing up editing a collection on Isao Takahata that I'm very excited about. There's some great stuff in there. So some great authors as well, producing some really interesting readings of his films and Takahata's contributions to Japanese cinema. But there are other people who worked for the studio for its entire history that we in English have talked very little about. And one of those was Toshio Suzuki. And Suzuki is, for me, the Ghibli mastermind. He's the reason you know about Studio Ghibli, if you do know about Studio Ghibli. Because he's the one who marketed the films. He's the one who kept the filmmakers working together when they fell out or had a squabble with one another. You know, he's the one behind the scenes who, when Hayao Miyazaki retires, will sidle up to him with a manga that he's into or a book that he thinks Miyazaki should read. And lo and behold, Miyazaki will be back making a new film a couple of years later. Very much Suzuki is the reason we still have, I think, Studio Ghibli. And he's a massively important person in the anime industry, but also in the Japanese film industry. So Stephen Alpert he worked for Studio Ghibli as their international marketing head for over a decade. And he's had a new book out last year where he's talked about his time working with the studio. And he points out that Toshio Suzuki, you know, when he starts getting involved with Studio Ghibli, is also the editor of the main Tokuma Shoten funded, so Tokuma Publishing funded anime magazine, Animage. He's also, though, in the time that he is creating Studio Ghibli as this successful studio, Suzuki is also the right-hand man for Tokuma Publishing. So he is very important to the Japanese publishing industry, very important to the Japanese film industry, and he's also building this studio, you know, just in his spare time, working with his friends. But I find Suzuki really important. Really interesting just in terms of how he has handled the development of Studio Ghibli. So in the early days of Studio Ghibli, it's not a production studio as we would think of a permanent production studio today. It was basically rented its studio space, and they would empty out the studio at the end of a production, close it down, and everybody would go off to new jobs. So it was only sort of around, sort of in existence, until Hayao Miyazaki makes Kiki's Delivery Service and the sales of Totoro merchandise really take off in the late 1980s, at which point they're finally able to get out of debt and to start making, start building a permanent studio where they can have people on permanent contracts. And so that's really the early 1990s is where Studio Ghibli really hits its stride. And that's a lot of that is Suzuki pushing in the background and handling the business side of things. And I think it's a fascinating thing because it's only after the studio becomes permanent that they start moving into other directions. And the first one they go into is advertising. So from about 1991, 92 onwards, Studio Ghibli starts to make TV ads for partner companies. So they've done TV ads for everything from home curry powders and foodstuffs to banks. There's a really interesting, I'll talk about it in a bit, I'm sure, but I've just finished doing some research on the Studio Ghibli ads, and there's a fascinating series of ads they did for a new bank that was formed called Resona. And it was supposed to be this fully fleshed out world, Hibiki Gaoka, and with loads of characters who had names. There was a dog that had a name. There was just this massively fleshed out world. But when they came to make the ad, Miyazaki was using everybody to finish, I think, Howl's Moving Castle. So there was just one animator at the time who had the capacity to work on these ads. And so this whole beautifully fleshed out plan of a world for Resona Bank's ads became just a few people standing against an orange background. So, I mean, it's fascinating when you start reading these stories about the company and what it was doing in advertising. Advertising for them was a place to test out new staff. It was a way to bring in more money. It was a way to test ideas. And so we see a lot of really interesting things happening in the ads, including some early work by people like, I'm going to get his name wrong, Momose, Yoshiyuki Momose, who is doing ads in a more 3D style using computers rather than doing them the traditional Ghibli way with 2D cell animation. So there's some really interesting stuff going on in these ads that is testing the market, testing the ground for whether people will accept a 3D Ghibli world. And those sorts of things are happening long before Goro Miyazaki comes along and starts trying to do things like Hedwig and the, or Earwig and the Witch.
And Goro Miyazaki is, of course, the famous director Hayao Miyazaki's son.
Yes, yes, absolutely. He's an interesting story in his own right. but Suzuki, Suzuki for me is I think he's just very good at selling Ghibli as a product, and he's been very good about the expansion of Ghibli beyond just films. But you see Hayao Miyazaki's hand in a lot of what they do as well. So it's often ideas that are come up with between Hayao Miyazaki and Toshio Suzuki, with maybe Isao Takahata involved. And there's a lot of discussion, a lot of collaboration, but then it will be Suzuki that gets the sign off from Miyazaki and then goes and makes it happen. So things like the Studio Ghibli Art Museum are fascinating because Miyazaki designs the building. But I suspect it was rather more Suzuki in the background taking all the meetings with the local city councils and city councillors, and the local park distribution agents, and you know, all the things that have to happen to make things come off. And he seems to have been, according to Steve Alpert, Steve Alpert's account, just a complete dynamo, just full of energy and doing all the work behind the scenes all the time to make Studio Ghibli into a success. And for me, what's fascinating to see is as Miyazaki's aging and as Suzuki is coming into his own a bit more, Suzuki himself starts to become a character designer for some of those commercials that they make for TV, including successful ones. Yeah.
Oh, so
it's a shift from behind the scenes to come out into the foreground, at least in Japan anyway.
And that behind the scenes work comes up a lot in your book. You talk about technological developments both within and outside of Japan. You talk about the Tokyo International Anime Fair, which is both an industry event and an event for fans. But we really have taken up a lot of your time. I wonder, though, since you have brought up Ghibli, and I happen to know there's a bit of a connection there, would you mind telling us a bit about what you're working on now?
I have just finished writing a manuscript, and this is why you should never stop me talking about Ghibli. I'm sorry if I have completely swamped the conversation with Ghibli things, but I have just sent off a manuscript for a new book on the industrial history of Studio Ghibli. So I've looked at how Studio Ghibli has written and rewritten its own history over the course of about 35, 40 years of production, on and off, at least lately. But how it has created itself and then recreated itself by talking to fans, to industry, to readers through autobiographies and biographies. So I've done a fair amount of translation of things in Japanese that have revealed to me a history of Ghibli that I didn't know when I started the project. I've been writing about Ghibli for 15 years at least, and I thought I knew this company, but there is so much more for you to discover if you read Japanese and go and look at the original sources. There's lots there. So the focus of the book is on the way Ghibli has talked about itself at different moments and throughout its past, and how it's sometimes changed its story over time. But also there's amazing stories out there in Japanese that just haven't really penetrated, haven't really been told outside of Japan. So one of the chapters of the book is about Ghibli's adoption of digital technologies. And they do that quite early. They start playing with that in the mid-1990s, just as Toy Story is coming out. So there's this assumption that Studio Ghibli is making traditional 2D cell animated filmmaking, and that's at the heart of the Ghibli company. But really, from quite early on, they're quite open to different kinds of digital animation. It's just that there are some great stories about how much Miyazaki hates it. But Miyazaki's right there on the ground when they start using digital tech, and he's really interesting in relation to it as well. There's big big stories that I wanted to investigate, like the problematic attempts to hand over from Hayao Miyazaki and Isao Takahata to new generations of directors, including Miyazaki's son, Goro Miyazaki, but also people like Hiromasa Yonebayashi. Their work in video games that is only just starting to be talked about, with things like the Ni No Kuni franchise that they did with Level 5, and things like the labor politics of Studio Ghibli, about the gender politics of Studio Ghibli. Hayao Miyazaki is often talked about as the most feminist of Japanese directors, and yet, there has never been a Studio Ghibli female director, and it doesn't look like it's on the cards at the moment either. But what's, and that's fascinating to me, particularly as they have, you know, pushed people from within the company up the ranks over the years, but they have never seemed to have successfully done that with women. There are no, as far as I can tell, no female directors of even the commercials. So there's interesting things happening with women at Studio Ghibli, despite the fact that Miyazaki is seen to be very good at creating female characters. So I think there's lots of stories there that I'm hoping won't make anime fans hate me or hate the book, but I think it's time to not just focus on the beautiful aesthetics and the wonderful themes that are in these movies, which are incredible films and incredible achievements in animation, but it's time to look behind the curtain a little bit for me and to think about how the studio has achieved the heights of fame internationally that it has achieved. And so that's, again, what I'm trying to do here in the new book.
Well, you certainly started that project sort of in a broader sense with Anime, A Critical Introduction.
Certainly, yes.
Which is it's fascinating and an enjoyable read, but also, as we say in Japanese, とても勉強になりました.
Thank you.
I really learned a lot from this book. And so I hope, I look forward to learning even more, but specifically about Studio Ghibli from the forthcoming book.
I hope everyone enjoys it.
I'm sure we will. Thank you very much, and I hope you have a lovely day.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for listening, and thank you, Amanda, for having me on today.